Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is a return guest. I think she was with us maybe a little over 2 years ago, Hannah Lynn. And her new book is The Women of Artemis, and it is a retelling of a Greek myth, ancient Greek myth, which is sort of seems to be what most of your recent books have been, that, haven't they?
Yeah, so I do write different genres, but the Greek myths are an absolute love of mine. I always come back to them. Yes.
So Hannah lives in the UK with her husband, daughter, and a horde of cats. Her first historical novel, Athena's Child, was a 2020 gold medalist at the Independent Publishers Award. And this is book number
five on the mythology.
Yes, wow. Series. So yeah. Five in 5 years.
A little longer from when they start. So obviously writing them and things.
Right.
I do feel like I have to upgrade the hordes of cats because we now have ourselves a puppy.
Oh.
And I feel like, yeah.
Oh, you can't leave out the puppy.
Welcome
back to Writer's Voices, Hannah.
Thank you very much for having me back.
What kind of puppy?
She's a German Shepherd.
Oh, I love German Shepherds.
She's amazing.
I grew up with a German Shepherd lab mix, and his name was Oscar, and I think my parents got him when I was one or something like that, and we had him until I was almost 14. So it is one of my first loves in dogs.
we have not had a German Shepherd before. My husband loves them, and we took the plunge, and I have to say it's, what's amazing about them isn't just the amazingness of the dogs. It's the amazingness of the community. We like have a meetup every Sunday with German Shepherd walkers.
So
everybody has shepherds, and it's amazing. And obviously with the mythology front, she is named Penthesilea after one of the Amazon warrior women. So that's actually a really great segue into the book.
It is.
So
The Women of Artemis is about how the Amazon tribe was founded, essentially.
How it came to be, the first Amazon queen, Atrera,
So tell me a little bit about what is in sort of the Greek canon about her.
Not much, and this is interesting in terms of my mythological books. This retelling is far more fictionalized without the canon than the other books that I have written. So even from my other Amazon warrior retelling is Queens of Themyscira. And in that one, I took the stories from Greek mythology, like where Hippolyta was with Heracles' belt and Theseus and all those matters, and joined them together into a story. With the Women of Artemis, there wasn't that. So it was much more, okay, she is the wife of Ares. That is the main thing. They are the women that worship Artemis. You know, they are the huntresses. And that's where I was building from. So it was a very different approach to writing.
Okay, so you didn't really have a lot that you were tied to. So you didn't know. Well, I don't think it's giving it away too many spoilers to say that in The Women of Artemis, these women are basically rebelling against being abused, is how it start being abused by really useless men. So that was your imagination.
So, there are some stories that is where they came from.
Okay.
And there are others about the men being away at war. And so there are various sort of loose, where did the women tribe start? And so that was the one that I was like, okay, I'm going to go for this element of the story.
Okay. All right. So what drew you to telling this particular story?
So much. So after Queens of Themyscira, I knew I wasn't done with the Amazons. I just so absorbed with them and their lifestyle and these women warriors that I needed more of them, and I needed sort of their origins in how they became that way. And so much is not a lot, but comparatively, we have a lot about Hippolyta and Penthesilea, but not her mother, Atrera, that was the first queen. And so I'm like, I want her story, because without her, we haven't got these queens. So yeah, I was drawn to her as a character and who she would be, because if we took that belief that they did come from, you know, these abused, sort of very downtrodden situations, and she rose to be the wife of Ares and a queen, that's a big old transformation. So writing that kind of character development, I was like, yes, that's something I wanted to get my teeth into.
Because she was not anybody special.
No.
Except that she had some guts and she had a talent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. She had a talent, but she also worked with that talent, and she also worked to bring it out in others as well. The same kind of things as, you know, just because I can do this, it doesn't mean you can't. And I say, I liked that about how I wanted that to be about that, you know, her and the women, is this is the life they wanted, they chose. So they put everything behind it to make that happen.
Yeah. So how long does it take you to write one of these books?
So my mythology novels, I'm always working on a mythology novel slowly in the background, because the themes in them, and this one is no different, can be quite draining emotionally. They are not a story that I can just sit down at a computer for 6 hours and just keep writing on, which I can with some of my other books, but these I would often found that I would step into it and step away. And so I cannot even tell you how long. I mean, I was working on this one for over a year. I can show you. I've got my paper draft that was umpteen drafts in, that I still keep with all my scribbles over it. So I think that was about third draft when I then went on to the crazy scribbling with paper and scribbling through. So yeah, I'll say a year and a half probably. I really can't, because obviously it's also then a very big time jump from when you give your book to a publisher, your editor,
right.
to when it's actually published.
So when you're not writing Greek myth retellings, what else are you writing?
So I write a variety of genres. I write rom-coms, romantic comedies, which I find, I call them my palate cleansers. Like when I am sort of done with the heavy thing and I can just have a cute meet cute and a bit of a laugh, they sort of free that aspect of my mind. And I also think it's what keeps me prolific and never tiring, always wanting to be sat at the computer, because I'm like, I want to be working on this and all of these ideas. So there's never a moment where I'm like, oh, do I feel like writing? I always feel like writing.
Wow, that's great. It's great that you're a writer, since you feel that way.
Wasn't so good when I had the other job before and I always felt like writing, you know?
yeah, no kidding. So rom-coms, and then are there other genres that you publish?
I have published thrillers under H.M. Lin, and I have pen names with some urban fantasy and co-writes and all sorts going
goodness.
On.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I, you know, my listeners can't see this, but I can see your bookshelves in your background there, and there's a lot of different colors of books.
It's the colors that give them away, isn't it?
Yes,
colors.
Yeah.
But I do say that, like, I love reading all genres. You know, I am a massive reader of all different genres of books, and so it's not really a surprise that I'm a writer of different genres of books as well. You know, it's where the mood takes me. So yeah, I am very much a storyteller. There is this story I want to tell, and that is the route that I go down.
And is it always clear when you have an idea what genre it will be? Or does it sometimes, you know, you have a character and you're not exactly sure where that character is going to go?
No, I think it is always clear, because I'm like, oh, that would be great for, you know, she would be a brilliant one in this situation or in this situation.
Right.
Yeah, I
right.
am always thinking of the genre when the plots and ideas and characters come to me.
So how many books have you published in total? Do you count? Do you keep count?
I do not keep count, but it is in excess of 30.
Goodness. And I, you know, you look very young, so.
I'll take that. I'll take it. Thank you. Possibly not as young as I look, but.
But I mean, you're not 70. Put it that way.
I'm not 70.
Or anywhere near.
But it is, like I said, it's funny because it is my favorite hobby now, as well as my job. So it's always a little bit of a bone of contention when we go on holiday as a family and everyone's like, okay, what do we want to do today? I'm like, well, if I can do anything I want to do, I want to write. We're like, but this is a holiday and you're not meant to work on holiday. But I'm like, but it's a holiday and I want to do my favorite thing. And my favorite thing is writing. So yeah, that is always a discussion. So normally we compromise and it's like, okay, you can read as much as you like, but, and I can plot, but laptops shouldn't
but
be
you're
out
not you're
all
not
the time.
Sitting in front of the computer. I wonder,
yeah.
you showed me your manuscript with the the paper manuscript.
Yeah.
So you said you do that at about third draft. So you start on computer completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a plotter.
Okay.
So I start with a plot. With an outline and quite a detailed one. So like with Women of Artemis, obviously, like I said, I've got a lot of free rein there. So, you know, I know who the main characters are going to be. I know a lot of the main scenes that are going to arise in the books. I know how the relationships are going to develop before I ever then start to write.
Okay. Some of that's on paper. Possibly.
And my plotting on paper will always be on paper or on, I've got a Kindle Scribe that I can keep my notes on. You know, I have all those. I like some form of writing down pen to paper, even if that's a digital pen. Digital
okay.
Paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to get one of those. And so I love it.
So you write with a
stylus, basically, right?
So I've got, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's, I really like plotting pen and paper, and I would never plot on a computer. I don't know why, that's a me brain thing. But the issue I was having is I have hundreds of notebooks and I would lose the plot, or I would spend ages looking for it. And I'd be like, it's in a blue notebook. And we'd be like, there are 14 blue notebooks in this house. And I was just spending so long. So like, I'm looking at my side now and I could see three blue notebooks. So I would spend so long doing that. It's like, okay, if I get a digital one, I'm still writing with my hand, but they are all there together and it's organized in folders and things, because obviously, you know, when a plot idea strikes and I'm out and I'd only got a different notebook, I would end up with half a plot in one and then another half in another, and it would be everywhere. So now I mainly use that to plot on. I say mainly because sometimes I do just love a notebook.
Yeah. Well, at least it's not sticky notes.
No, I'm not sticky notes. I used to just be A4 pieces of paper. Like I would find one out the printer and then they'd just end up everywhere. And that was a nightmare. So it tries to be notebooks or those. So that is always my first thing is my plot. But then I don't ever feel like I know my characters until I finish the first draft, and then I'm like, okay, now I know you, now I can go back and I can see, okay, did you act the way you should have done in that scene, or would you have done something different here, or should I have included an extra scene in here or taken that one out? So it's always after my first draft that I feel like I know the characters, and then in my second draft I go through that. With my rom-coms, I would normally then just do a clean up one after that. with my Greek, and then on the pen and paper, printing it out again, because how you read it on paper, I feel, is so is different to reading it on the computer, but that's just a me. So I then go through and do a paper draft, which is one of my favorite drafts to do, because I go and sit in a cafe. And I sit somewhere with cake and tea, or if it's later in the day, with a glass of wine, and I go through it there. So that's possibly my favorite draft to do.
So that's living the dream, right?
That's the bit that people imagine with the author, not the everyday, like, okay, writing, sitting in front of the computer, doing all that. That's the bit that people dream about, with a glass of wine and a few strike through, a lot of strike throughs here and there.
And then when you have made those like handwritten changes, do you put them all in, or do you ever hire somebody to like make?
No,
them
I put them all in.
You put them, put all, them in. All in. And then as you're doing that, as you're going back to the computer, do you necessarily make every change that you made on paper, or do you rethink it as you're doing it?
So what I did with those ones is I made them all, then I reread them, read it, and went again. It was interesting, actually. So the Women of Artemis, my editor was like, I need you to cut 40,000 words from it.
What?
She's like, it's too big. Yeah, this one here was 160,000. So this one, I know your readers can't see, but I could show you. There are massive pages with just lines through the whole thing, because I was trying to cut everything I could. And so I cut as much as I could, did that on the computer, then went through and had another write and put a load more back in again. So then I sent it to my editor and went, it's on you. I'm sorry. I can't work out where to cut it. This is over to you now.
And did she actually cut that much?
She did. She did. She was wonderfully ruthless and cut it all that needed to be cut. So I'm grateful, because it's a better book because of it.
Oh, my goodness. So 40,000 out of how many did you start with?
It was 160,000.
That's a 25% of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, you know, was it Ernest Hemingway who said about you have to kill your darlings, you know, that sometimes what you cut is favorite line,
favorite bit. Yeah,
but it just doesn't work in the story. Did that happen
in this one? I don't know about the individuals, because she cut a lot. My favorite bits stayed in, which I am grateful for. Like, yeah, a lot of my favoriteest bits, which unfortunately are normally deaths.
Oh. Yeah, this book has a lot of tragedy. Of course, Greek myths always do. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, of the other characters other than Otera, how many of them are people that had been written about, and how many?
Other than,
yeah.
So the Gargarians as a whole, they were written about the group, but not in the way that I had done it with the separation with the men at all. And then obviously Ares and the children, but the rest of them are from my head.
Okay, so Phil, how do you pronounce
it? Yeah, I pronounce it Philae, but Philae, And
so Philae was from your imagination, and her partner, whose name I know it started with a D, but I'm forgetting now what it was.
Why have I want to go Hurtus, but it's not.
No, or is it? Maybe it was.
It is Hurtus.
Okay. Yeah. So, all right.
Good thought. I was losing my mind there. Yeah. So it's okay. It's all good. Yes. So I have to say, my favorite character in the book is Ina, though. She was a favorite of mine. And I don't normally get attached to characters who aren't the main character quite as much.
So tell us a little bit about sort of the arc of the story and then how Aina fits into that.
So as we've mentioned before, so the idea is that these women were not given a great lot in life with their husbands, with their situations. They were living in a very isolated village, and the source of income came from a tannery, but they were pretty much at their husband's behest to do as they wished to them, which wasn't particularly pleasant. Lots of beatings and so on and all, as you can imagine. And so Atrera decides that enough is enough. They have one man in the town, Hurtus, who is the owner of the tannery's unofficial husband. And he is a character who treats the women with the respect they deserve and treats them like people, because he is a former slave, very much knows what it's like not to be seen from that side. So he teaches Atrera and a couple of the others to shoot with bow and arrow, with the idea that, hunting, they can become more self-sufficient for food. But Atrera has other ideas of what she is going to do with her bow and arrow, and convinces the women to rise up against the men. But one of the other really well-known aspects of the Amazon warriors is how they fought on horseback. It's what made them such formidable opponents, because the speed of the horses outweighed any sort of strength advantage that their opponents might have. So I wanted to introduce this element of the horses and learning to ride. And I lie when I said Aina was my favorite character, because actually my favorite character was Erebus, who is Atrera's horse in this. And it's very much a story of different loves. So, there's the maternal love in there. There is the friendship, the platonic love. And there's a gratitude that they feel for other people. So that, there are elements of romance in this book, but in no way is it a romantic book. It's about the relationships between these women and all of them giving and sacrificing to achieve this life that they want, because there has to be sacrifice to achieve it. And it's about that element. And I absolutely loved writing it. I don't know whether it's a good thing or not, but I cried more writing this book than any book I have written.
Well, I cried reading it too. So
I gotta say, I'm glad. Thank you, Sarah. It's always a strange thing to do, but we are always glad as writers when we've got you into us. So
yeah.
I'm pleased.
So do we know historically when people started riding horses? And is it accurate that the Amazons were the only ones at the time? I mean, if the Amazons actually really existed, but
yeah. They did.
They did. Okay.
I'm looking here on my bookshelf. If you'd like to read Adrian Mayer's book on it, the faction one, it's absolutely brilliant. I'm not 100% sure on the timings, but I do believe, they absolutely, people would have had domesticated and be riding horses at that time. They weren't in that particular area, and it was her that learnt, but it, wouldn't have been unheard of.
Okay. But it was sort of shocking, to everyone else around.
I think the wild aspect horse as well, because I don't, where we are, wild horses aren't something that you would consider, really.
Yeah.
It was a shock from that life for her to see people, or particularly Aina, riding a wild animal, and said that's where she was drawn to wanting to do the same, but not on any horse, just on the stallion Erebus was the one that she was drawn to. I think there are some people that have those relationships with animals, aren't there? That mm-hmm. that do have a just a different, somehow on par level with them, and that you know, I would love to be. I think my brother is very good with animals, but also my husband and cats. I'll tell you now, my husband and cats, if you have problems with a cat, he is just goes in and seems to know what to do with them. So it's a bit of a bigger scale with the horses, but yeah, it was that relationship I wanted to get across.
Well, Hannah, why don't you read a little bit from The Women of Artemis?
Oh, I would love to. Went through trying to find the right bit because I often read from the beginning. And I decided not to read from the beginning at this one. I actually am over halfway at chapter 59. But bear in mind what we have spoken about. I don't think it should give away too many spoilers. So there were 7 women and 9 children. The decision should have been an easy one, for without our acceptance, they would be condemned to death. But we had to see beyond the moment. If we accepted these and more could follow, or worse, men could seek them out. The debate rolled late into the night, yet in their hearts, even the most fearful knew it would end the same way. "They will stay," I said, my tone declaring the finality on the matter that would otherwise have been debated well past dawn. "I will go now and speak to Soteria." The dismissal had only been implied, but the women knew me well enough to know what my words meant and rose to their feet. Soon, only Damaris remained. "You wish to come with me?" I said, assuming that was her reason for lingering, but she shook her head. Her pupils grew so wide it was as if she had been plunged into darkness. Only when every last woman was out in the night did she speak. "What is it? Something is wrong?" I said. She nodded. I did not wish to say anything in front of the others, for fear it would alarm them, but when we met with the women on the road, I saw 6 crows circling. "6 crows?" I questioned. "They circled to the left, looping 3 times around these women. I believe if we are to offer them refuge, there will be consequences." Her face was stern, and I recalled the woman I had met when I first arrived in Inya, the quiet waif who had looked at me with such a curious gaze it had caused my skin to prickle. It had been a long time since I had viewed Damaris in such a manner. Resting my hand on her arm, I spoke. "Thank you. I believe what you saw, but I'm sure you are mistaken, for I saw only swallows and sparrows. Artemis has protected us always and will protect these women too now. Now come. They'll be waiting to hear our answer." Within days, it was as if Soteria and her women had always been with us. They may have only provided 7 more pairs of hands, but they were hands that worked tirelessly from dawn to well past dusk. They took their meals last, washed other women's and children's clothes with their own, and constantly sought out ways to aid us. Soteria had not lied about Boreana's skills at sewing. Still, it was hard to look at her handiwork without a throb forming in my chest as I remembered Melita. But she had underplayed her own skill with the wood. In a matter of minutes, Soteria could whittle an arrow that was smoother and straighter than any I could have achieved in a full day of trying. Our first winter without the men, we thrived. Every home was warm, every belly full, and every woman survived. Those accomplishments alone would have been enough to fill my heart. But there was one other, one that happened before the snow came, when the leaves still fell from the trees. And as with so many things in my life, it was Ina who was central to making it happen. "I believe if we could coax the rest of the herd closer to the village, they might stay there," she said. "Marina is growing more comfortable around the houses. Arebus too. We could build them stables. That way others could learn to ride too." "I think perhaps we have enough tasks at hand before we start building stables," I replied, anticipating how Arebus would feel confined within 4 walls. I believe that he, like the rest of us, felt comfortable in the village because he held the power to leave. "But will you think about it?" Ina asked, still with that childlike eagerness in her voice. Though no stables were built, The herd stayed close throughout the coldest month, and just as she had dreamt, more and more women took to their backs. Yet, when spring arrived, the first of our fears came to fruition. I was riding a rebus that morning, and the height offered me a vantage point from which I could see down the valley. My stomach knotted. A mass of women and children walked the path up to Ninya. Kicking my heels into a rebus, we galloped the short distance to the rest of the women. Atrera, Soteria was the first to see me. I did not know, I promise you. None of us did. You know these women? I believe so. Tears filled Soteria's eyes. I believe it is the rest of the women from the village. Village, Damara spoke. It looks as though half of Athens has come from us. I promise you, Atrera, they have no weapons, no means or knowledge of how to attack. One winter together, and Soteria had already learned enough about me to know that my first thoughts were about protection. They are peaceful, like us. They only come for sanctuary. I fear their lives worsened after we left. They will help you, Atrera, just like we did. I did not count the numbers, but from my brief study, I knew there were 100 more mouths to feed. Atrera, look, please. Damaris tilted her head upwards as she spoke. There, circling above the lines of women and children, there were 6 crows. It is the same as I saw before. We should not do this. These were not swallows or sparrows, and a shallow apprehension fluttered within me, though I quashed it. I did not have time to pander to a different god's superstition. I trusted Artemis. This is who we are now, I spoke as much to myself as to Damaris. We are the women who stand together. That all right.
That was great. That's Hannah Lynn reading from The Women of Artemis. You are such a great reader.
Thank you.
I mean, do you do your own audiobooks?
No, I have. Oh, you I have should. Only done no, because I can't do any accents. I can't do any accents or any change of voice. So I just have my voice to read in. If I could learn, I would love to. But no, I think people would be like, all her characters sound identical. It's like, yes, they would. They would.
I'm assuming all of your books do become audiobooks.
Yes, they do.
And are you involved in the process at all?
Listening to narrators, but not very much, very much on the outside of it.
Yeah.
But I do love them. We do listen to the audiobooks when we're driving.
That's wonderful.
So, well, actually, I tell you what, normally my husband listens to them because I struggle to listen to my own words. So he will listen to them with the headphones on.
Okay.
And it's quite funny because he'll be getting to a place and he'll be like, oh my gosh, like every time something happens. And I love his responses when I'm doing it. So a lot of fun.
Now does he see your manuscripts in progress?
He used to when I started off, very much so, and would give me advice. He actually studied English and film and media and was an English teacher. I was a physics teacher. So of the pair of us, I'm probably not the one you would have expected to go into writing full time. So he used to. But now I think it. Yeah, having discussions with editors on what to change is very different than having to with your husband.
Yes, yes.
So those days are gone now, and I think he is much happier because of that.
yeah, it's hard to get to hear criticism from your partner.
It is, especially when they're right. I don't want to hear that you're right. It's like, yeah.
Now, the men, the group of men that separated off, and they have a name that I can't remember.
The Gargarians.
Gargarians.
Yes.
So are they, I was unfamiliar with them. So tell us a little bit about how they appear in your book, but also in the Greek myth.
So again, there is very limited of them, but they are referred to as the tribe that the Amazon women would meet, and the boys would go to them, and the women would stay with the Amazons. So that was their way of explaining, I guess, why there were no men with these Amazon warrior women.
And yet they were able to have children. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, with me, I wanted to sort of have them starting out together and that branch of them, because also, you know, they want every man in the book to be cast under the same, you know, they are all terrible, because it's so important in all of my books, you know, because they are from female point of views. I'd like, but I have bad women and I have bad men. And I have good women and I have good men. And that's the same in all of my books. And that's always really important to me, that it's, you know, that it is balanced in that way, because in real life, you know, there is a balance. So, yeah, I wanted to have some of those characters that were the great male role models and that they could look up to, and they did want to be, you know, the father of their children. And also make that decision for Atreus a little bit tougher at times.
Oh, yeah. Would you ever write their story?
Yes, I wouldn't say no to that. So my thing is always kind of write the stories that haven't been told much. And if I could find out more about them, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. Yeah, yeah. That would be interesting. Did you do a lot of research for this book? You showed me that the Women of Artemis,
the Amazons,
do you go back and read Homer?
I go back. With the other ones, if I tilt my computer next to you, you see that this row here is all my researchy books. So I have got my Homer on there. I've got my Iliad. I got my Odyssey.
What are those wine bottles with homemade labels?
Okay. So these. I'll take that one off because that's there. So these are my Prosecco goals. So what I do is, these ones here are full. So like I've got one here which is my dream pull quote. So I have got that on a little Prosecco bottle. So a dream pull quote, so like from, you know, a Madeline Miller or an Elodie Harper, they would be one of my dream people who would quote my book. And then when I meet a goal, I get to drink the bottle of Prosecco. So there's two more. So that one for last year was, I wanted to meet more of my readers. I wanted to do 4 in-person events to meet more of my readers. And so once I had done that, I got to drink my bottle of Prosecco, and I love my Prosecco goals.
Do you have any others you would share with us?
I would love a bestsellers list. So that one is, that I would love, you know, whether it's a Times bestseller or a New York Times, that's,
Right.
Yeah. So if your listeners would like to help me get this one.
I'm surprised you haven't drunk that one already, to be honest.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This is the one I really want to open. I'm not going to lie. This one sits beside me, glaring at me the whole time, going, when are we going to be open?
Now, The Women of Artemis comes out October 21st in the US. Has it already been published in the UK?
Nope.
Or is this the
21st as well? Yeah.
Okay.
So
let's see what we can do to get you drinking that bottle of Prosecco.
You can pre-order it now. If anybody would like to help me drink my Prosecco, that would be really helpful. So thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate it. It's one of those fun things. And you know, I love what I do. I never take it for granted. And I'm always sort of looking forward with it as well. You know, I'm always like, okay, what's the next goal? What do I want to do? Yeah.
Now, you know, we've talked a lot. We've talked about your writing process. We've talked about how you never run out of ideas. But I see you also offer coaching services. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
So yeah, because well, I kept getting asked, and also I used to be a teacher, obviously a physics teacher, as you know, but I genuinely missed the teaching side of things. Not the paperwork, I won't go that side of stuff, but the teaching I really liked. So I was running classes for novel writing, like group classes, and from those got asked if I would do coaching, and so yeah, sort of developed into that. So I only ever work with a couple of people at a time, because it's one of those that, you know, want it to be purposeful and want it to be for people who really want to write that book, you know, to sort of avoid some of the pitfalls I did, but also have that accountability, because, you know, it's one of those things that life gets in the way a lot of the time. But it's also interesting, because I was talking to my husband, what I talked about, I would always, it's all I, the only person I see, because, you know, I'm just in an office writing. So, yeah.
Until you get the paper draft and go to your coffee shop.
Until I go to my coffee shop.
Yeah.
I was talking to him, and it's one of those things that when you're talking about people who are actors that are, you know, who are working in coffee shops, in bars, they always refer to themselves as an actor, but they're working in a bar. Yeah, they're an actor, but they're, or a screen, they're doing that. But with writers, right, it's a little bit different. There's always that kind of reticence to say you're writing a book. And I think with that reticence to say it, also, if you keep it inwards, maybe it doesn't matter if you don't get it done so much, and nobody needs to know that you never quite finished it. And I think having that accountability and that support, and also to go, you know, yes, you can, because there are other people who go, you know, I could never write a book. I've always wanted to. It's like, but you can learn. You know, when I always wanted to write books, but, you know, I was like, I don't think I'm good enough. I don't think, you know, I studied physics. What business do I have writing books? But then when I made the decision that actually, you know, I do want to do this. And it came about because I was working in Thailand at the time. And I had grown up with a mindset that was this gift to me, that was very much, you are good at what you're good at, right? So I was good at the music and the maths. My little brother was good with animals. It was, you know, a friend was good at dancing. You are good at what you are good at, and you stay in your lane and you do that thing. And so the fact that I loved writing didn't matter, because that wasn't the lane I was in, you know. And I did have one of my English teachers go, oh, you don't, you should be doing English A level. I was like, I don't, yeah, but I'm not as good at it as I am at physics and the sciences, so I should be doing that.
Well, you're, it's interesting, because you're definitely younger than I am, because in my generation, a woman would never have been pushed into sciences over English.
Well, I tell you what, there were three of us in my physics class with girls, as compared to like the 20 in English. But
yeah.
So it's very much in that route. And then we moved to Thailand, and I was teaching, you know, teaching physics, and the students had a very different attitude, and the attitude was that they want to do it, so they will do what it takes to make it happen. They had a growth mindset, essentially, which wasn't what we had grown up with at the time. It wasn't, you know, a term used there, but it also wasn't what we saw. And, you know, I'd have students coming to me going, you know, I really want to do this science course. I know my grades aren't there. You give me 3 months and I will work and I will prove to you that I can get it. And they did every time, because they wanted it. And I was like, okay, well, if I want to write, then I've got to go at it with this same attitude. I've got to learn everything I can. I've got to have faith in myself that I am going to be able to do this. And so I did. So I was just like, you know, it was like, what do you want for Christmas? It's like, there's this writing course. I want to do this big writing course. It's like, you know, what are we doing this weekend? It's like, there's a lecture on here. I'm going there. So I was just absorbing all of that. And with that came the belief that, okay, yeah, I actually, I can do that. And it took a, you know, still took a long time when I was nominated for the Kindle Storyteller Award. My husband didn't come to the award ceremony with me because I didn't think I'd win, because the others were full-time writers. And I did win, and he was stuck at home with our daughter, and I was drinking champagne in London. So the belief took a little bit of time. But I want to be able to make that in other people as well, you know, be that voice that's like, if you want this, let's work to achieve it. You know, it's so, you just so got to put in that effort.
That you said you were in Thailand when you sort of made this leap. What was it? Was there something there that happened there in particular that caused to change your mindset?
It was so many of the students, if I'm honest. It was an ethos around the school.
Okay. That
was so different to what I had come for. So, for example, we have like the music exams. These children were excelling in music, and they were excelling in art, and they were excelling because they chose to, because they wanted to, because they prioritized, and that just hadn't been, like I said, I went to a very good school, but I went to a small school. So I was the musical and the science one, you know, and there wasn't room to negotiate out of that. So to see, you know, children of a young age go, but this is what I want to do, and commit to that was a real mindset. So like with my daughter now, from the age dot, I've been like, how do you get good at something? It's like, practice. It's like, that's it. I mean, she doesn't always, if I could get her to embody, like, she's like, I can't do this drawing. It's like, we have been doing this since before you were born. How do you get good at it? It's like, practice. Like, you have to put the practice in. You know that. But I hope that at someday it will click with her, because
now that there is one downside to what you're saying, and that is that I have known people who are good at a lot of different things, and then they just end up dabbling in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And never really focused to get accomplished. Yeah, you have to commit.
Yes,
and you can't commit to everything.
No.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. And it's like, if you like the waiter who says he's, you know, the actor waiter, they're committing to the acting. They're saying that's what they're doing. That is what they're doing. And I think with the writing, yeah, if it's what you want to do, you can do it. But you have to commit to it. And it always surprises people. And I tell them, like, if you were to write 600 words a day, in 4 months, you could have a first draft of a book.
Yeah.
And people look at me like that's insane, but I'm like, but do the maths.
Yeah.
Do the math.
Yeah.
You've got to commit to that 600 words a day for 4 months, and then you've got it. Seeing it like that in the black and white with number, and 4 months is a doable. You're getting your calculator.
Yeah, I am. Because I'm a math person. All right. So you got 72,000 words.
People, think that's insane, but
yeah,
it's not at all.
No.
So 70,000 is, there's a lot of my books are around there, and I've got some that are smaller than that still. So it's trying to encourage people with that, you know. Yeah.
Now, so, do you write every day?
Yes.
And how does she have a daughter? You have just the one, or
I have a daughter. Yeah. Daughter. Yeah.
And how old is she?
She's 10.
She's 10. So
she's 10, yeah.
Does she want to be a writer?
She does. I think that's because she just thinks that she'll get to live at home forever with us, which I don't know if that's ideal. No, she does write a lot of stories. We went on a holiday, and she decided she was going to use that holiday to write her first book. And bless her, we did a 4-day canal boat. I think she wrote 5,000 words.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing!
Just like getting a story down, you know. So. Yeah. Editing she's not so keen on. She's like, it's done. I'm like, you go and edit that.
I actually love editing.
I love editing. I love it. I love the whole bit. Do you know what? That's the thing. I've said it. I love plotting. I love plotting. I don't know. There's just, and my final version will have loads of other bits in as well as my plot. You know, I'm always adding scenes in. Like I said, when I get to the end and I'm like, this is the character, it needs its other ones. But I love plotting. I love getting that first draft down and seeing that come to life. I love editing it and making it like the best, but there is not a stage apart from marketing. I'll put that in there. Apart from marketing.
Well, this is part of marketing and you seem to be enjoying this, yourself.
I do like that. This talking to people, I love, but making videos, those I find hard.
Yeah.
I find hard. Selling my books, I find hard. Talking about writing is
different.
Is easy.
Yeah. Do you have social media accounts that you have to post on?
Yeah.
Yeah, Facebook, that's part of the artist or the author's life now. Yeah.
It is very much so.
Do you have a favorite platform?
I probably connect most people on Facebook, and I really enjoy the connection with readers. And like I said, like, I'm doing more in-person events and people will have connected on Facebook and then they'll come and see me, and you know, that relationship is really lovely. So I really appreciate that side of it. Yeah. It's just time, you know, it's often time, isn't it? That's the issue with all our things. And as I said, like, I like to be writing. It's very difficult to sort of drag me away from the writing.
Now, a lot of writers are revealing a lot of themselves in their writing. Of course, memoir writers the most, but a lot of contemporary fiction too. They're, you know, a lot of the authors that I talk to, there's elements of the book or the character or the story that really are them. In these books, like in The Women of Artemis, is there any of you or your life in there?
There are definitely always elements of myself with relationships, I think, is where a lot of fears of relationships come into mind. I'd say most of myself is in Daughters of Olympus, where, you know, Demeter has got the anxiety over her only daughter, and that what, you know, is love is overbearing and controlling. That element of sort of protectiveness and anxiety is a strong part. Like, I always say, it's like, she's a mother with one daughter and she suffers from anxiety. I'm like, that was given for me, write into it. So yeah. I do bring a lot of that into it, definitely. And I think with the relationships with Atrera and with the just pushing herself to do better, be better, that's a bit of me. You know, we could take it a step further. We could take it a step further, you know. Be as well.
Okay. All right. Now, you write some books that your daughter can read too, right?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay. No. I thought maybe some of the family. There were, when I was looking at your webpage, there were some that looked like they might be more for younger readers. But
no.
Okay.
I have looked at children's, but now I've told her she's got to be 13. 13. And
okay.
Then she can read my first Greek one, Athena's Child. That one she's allowed it.
Okay. And I think Athena's Child might have been the book that we talked about on Writer's Voices a few years ago.
Yeah.
And do you have more Greek books in the works?
I am always working on.
Yep.
Absolutely. So we'll have to wait and see where that goes. But yes, there is definitely one in the works.
All right. And have you ever, like when I was asking about your research, do you actually go back and read Homer and you know,
not cover to cover, I will say. No, I tend to dip in and out now. I'm like, oh, I need to find that bit. And that bit is more of my approach.
Yeah. Is there any way that your science background gets brought into your books, or would you ever?
I don't have the science. I once had a review in one of my books going, this person knows nothing about basic science, and I made a note to myself, never put too high a level of science in, because then obviously I was like, that's not a basic level of science. I would say my teaching as a whole does go into it, because I was doing a talk somewhere, and when I said I was a teacher, she's like, that makes so much sense, because my stories are very accessible, as if, you know, I want them to be accessible for everybody, the same way as when you are teaching a lesson, you want the lesson to be accessible for all your learners in a class.
Right.
So I think I go into it the very similar way like that. Yeah.
So Hannah, do you have any words of advice for somebody who really wants to write a book?
You've got to commit to it.
Yeah. Write 600 words a day.
Words a day. It's that commitment. It is. And also, don't be aiming for perfect. Because I think that is the other thing that stops people. You get that first draft done and you go and edit it. But instead, people will spend so much time on that first chapter, on that first scene, going back and back. And you know what? If you think about it, like we said, things will be cut. A lot of things are going to be cut or are going to be changed. And it's a lot harder to do that when you have spent 3 months on this one scene.
Yes.
That then you find out you don't need. Get to the end of that first draft. When you've got to the end of it and you know what you need, then you can, you know, edit till your heart's content, make those lines sing, you know, pull out all the details and intricacies you want, but you have to finish the book.
And how do you know when you're done editing?
Oh, it's when there's no more niggles to go back and check, I think. you could have the niggles forever. I mean, normally it's when I go, right, this is going to the editor. Like with that one, I could have edited forever. I didn't think that what I was doing was tipping the balance better or worse, or, you know, it's like, what am I doing? I will give that.
Yeah.
Give that away. You could always
absolutely. I've had authors say, you know, even once the book's published, there's things they wish they could change, but.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why I said I don't like listening to them. Because I'm like, why did you choose that? Why did you do that? Like, no, I don't like reading my books afterwards. For that reason. But, you know, if you're aiming for perfection, you will never get it done.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You will aim it. And, you know, but you will get better on the next book and on the next book. And if you keep writing, you will improve, but you're not going to be able to improve on that one chapter. So,
well, Hannah, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us again on Writers' Voices with the Women of Artemis. And I'm going to read a quote from that book by Adrienne Mayer about the Amazons. She wrote, "The Greeks were extremely ambivalent about the stories of Amazons. They found them both thrilling and rather daunting at the same time."
I think that's just what I love, yeah. Adrienne Mayer, yeah. With that. Well, thank you ever so much for having me here. I have absolutely loved talking to you again. It's been really great. So thank you.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.